Okay, girls, I'm just going to introduce myself. My name is Azaria Berzon. If you remember that, you get an A in the course. And I'm here to talk to you about the development of halakha, some of the rules, some of the background, and something that may be meaningful for all of us. If you happen to have this booklet, you can turn to page 18 if you like, and you'll see that the title of this section is called Torah Misinai. Now that's a very heavy phrase, Torah Misinai. Can anybody tell me what that means?
Torah from Sinai.
Okay, that's a literal translation, but what's so powerful about the idea? Why is it so important to speak about Torah Misinai? Why do I need that? What happened at Har Sinai, girls? Help me out here. We received the Torah, and basically, you know, all of Judaism, all of our beliefs are predicated on the fact that the Torah was received at Har Sinai. That was the mountain that was very humble. It was not one of these tall mountains. You know, if you want to see the tall mountains, you might have to go to Switzerland or other places on the face of the earth. In Alaska, they have Mount Everest. This was a humble kind of a mountain. And there, our leader, probably, I guess we'd all agree, was the greatest leader of all times for the Jewish people. That's Moshe Rabbeinu, right? He went up to the top of the mountain. And there he received the Torah. How many days was he on top of the mountain? 40 days. And our rabbis teach us that for those 40 days, he was preoccupied exclusively with receiving the Torah from God. And 40 days and 40 nights. He didn't sleep, he didn't eat. He was like an angel from heaven. And he received two Torahs. Okay, now, how many Torahs are there? You know, we would all like to agree there's only one Torah, right? But in truth, that's not accurate. How many Torahs are there? Two. What are the two Torahs? Torah Shmechsav, that's the oral Torah, okay? Anybody want to write that on the blackboard or in your notes? Torah Shmechtav, that's the written Torah. And then we have another Torah, which is called Torah Sheba'al Peh, which is the oral law. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions about that and keep them in mind. Number one, which of the two Torahs is more important? Okay, write that down. And number two, I want to ask you the following questions. How do we know that Moshe Rabbeinu received the oral law? But I think number three, and this is the most profound of all the questions, is why? Why didn't God give us just the written law? That would have been, I think, an easy one. And the written law would have certainly been accurate and something that we could pass on through the generations. In fact, we have a concept, in English it's called controversy, and in Hebrew it's called machloket. So if you want to write that down also, machloket. And the history of the development of halakha, of Jewish law, is all about machloket. It's really all about controversy. And if I were to ask certain questions about Jewish law, I'm sure we'd get a number of different opinions, different traditions, different customs. And that's all because of what's called Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. You know, had we had the written law, if everything would be in the books. Like, for example, in secular law, you know, you pay a lawyer because he knows the books, but he can refer to the books. And if he presents his opinion, he's going to quote the law books. It's all written down. In fact, I'm not sure if you're all aware of this, in a law document, not only do they record the majority opinion, but even the dissenting opinion is also recorded in the law books. And the reason for that is that at some point, the dissenting opinion is going to be important for the history of development of law. All this is written down. And yet, in the case of halakha, very little of it is written down. We have the five books. Yeah, but how much of that is law? In fact, what's the first law in the Torah? Where does it appear? Not at the beginning, yeah? What is your name?
Sarah Brina.
Sarah Brina? I like that name, Brina. My mother's name was Brina, yeah. Brit Milah is given to Abraham. But the mitzvah that's given to us of Brit Milah is going to be given much later on. And that's in Parsha Shmini. But I'm not even going to go into that. But what's the first major mitzvah of the Torah that's given for the Jewish people for all time? Excellent. What is your name?
Carmel.
Did I get that right? Carmel? Okay. So Carmel says it's the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, which means that we sanctify the new month. And that appears in what parsha of the Torah? In Bo. Now, if you take Sefer Bamidbar, which is the fourth of the five books of Moses, there's almost no mitzvahs there at all. So you could probably reduce the entire Torah of the written Torah of five books, if you wanted to talk about mitzvot, commands and laws, you could probably reduce it to one-fifth of the Torah. So we don't have a massive amount of written Torah. And therefore, the bulk of what we have for Jewish law is in the oral Torah. The oral Torah takes us back to our Sinai, but it's not written. And the fundamental question I want to ask you, which is written here on the top of your page 18, if you happen to have this booklet that Rabbi Manning put together so beautifully, is a presentation of a thesis as to why the Torah was given, not one Torah, but two Torahs, not just the written Torah, but the oral Torah. And in fact, as we said, the bulk of Jewish law, the bulk of customs and traditions, is not in the written Torah, but rather in the oral tradition. And why is that so? Wouldn't it make sense, and couldn't life have been that much easier had it been all recorded in the written law? Okay then? So girls, I don't know, I'm sure at your age, you're mature women, if you're using a phone, there must be a very urgent reason for it.
I took a picture of the text so you don't
have it. Okay, great. So I'm glad you told me that, because phones get me so distracted, I get lost. Now, everyone should shut off their phone. The only thing is, I'm not sure if I shut off my phone. So if a phone goes off, it's mine. There was a great giant by the name of the Chofetz Chaim. Maybe you heard of him. He lived about a century ago. So he used to say that when he had guests at his table for Shabbos, and I want to talk to you girls about maybe being guests at our table. So they say that the Chofetz Chaim used to take the wine of Kiddush and he used to spill a little bit on the table. Why would he do such a thing? Not to embarrass any of the guests if they spilled. He already spilled on the table, so the tablecloth's already dirty. And the Gemara tells us that one time Rebbe smelled a terrible odor in the classroom, and he said, there's somebody here who ate garlic. So who's the guy who ate garlic? So the entire class stood up and walked out, so as not to embarrass the person who ate the garlic. So I left my phone on, so in case it goes off, I'm the one who's going to be embarrassed, and you won't be embarrassed. Anyway, getting back to the oral law. So you have here a presentation on the top of page 18 in the name of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. And if you're not familiar with him, you should get to know his books, his writings, because he is one of the great philosophers of Jewish philosophy in modern times. He was a rabbi, anybody know where? Hirsch, in Germany, correct. He was the great leader of German Jewry in about 1850. And he has many philosophical insights. He has a great, fabulous work on mitzvot called Chorev. And in that work, his student asks him about all the mitzvot, one after the other, why God gave this mitzvot, what's its purpose, what's its meaning. But fundamentally, he wants to know why the oral law. And he gives what's called a metaphor, a very interesting metaphor. And he says the following. If you have a lecturer in a class, let's say it's on a high level, it's a college class, post-grad, then what happens is the students in the class are meant to do what? Listen, of course. And if they want to record the class, back in the time of Hirsch, they didn't have all the technology. What did they do? They wrote?
Notes.
Notes are summaries. Now, the reason why it's critical to write notes is because it's virtually impossible to include the entire lecture in a written text, because the lecturer speaks very quickly, and there's a lot of... So there are people who are very, very well trained, and they're experts and professionals about writing a tremendous amount on a page in a short amount of time, but for most of us, we need notes. The oral Torah is the notes. These are the notes that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, where Hashem was giving him the Torah at a very fast pace, in a very short amount of time. It was a massive amount of material. It was virtually endless, infinite, and Moshe Rabbeinu wrote notes. Now, when you write notes, what are the two main points, the two main goals that you have when you write notes? Number one, the notes have to be what? Abridged, concise, right? It can't be, because you don't have time to write the whole. But number two, You want to be able to look back at your notes and do what?
Comprehend.
To reconstruct the lecture. So the notes have to highlight the main points of the lecture. So note-taking is a discipline unto itself. And the oral law that was given to Moshe at Mount Sinai was given with the ability for Moshe Rabbeinu to write, how should we say it, an outline form. And the outline form was meant to codify the basic principles. And from those principles, we're going to apply them to individual cases. I would like to go one step further and suggest, based on Rav Hirsch, that maybe we can enhance what Rav Hirsch is saying by saying the following. What's unique about the Torah as a legal system that makes it existentially, fundamentally different than any other legal system?
Our laws are meant to change.
Okay, change. Now, here we get into, you know, very, very esoteric issues where the halacha changes or not. In a sense, the principles remain the same, but their applications change. Now, when we get to the concept of applying the law, where does Torah play a major, major role? And it's very unique. It's a legal system unlike any other legal system. Anybody?
It's not all written down.
Okay, that's true. But I'm talking about the greatness of Torah. Can you think about the quality of Torah? Can you describe Torah with one adjective that makes Torah unique? No other legal system can make this claim.
Emes.
Divine.
Emes.
Truth. Okay, what else? Divine truth. What else?
Eternal.
Who said eternal? What's your name?
Ashley.
I can't hear you.
Ashley.
Lee. Ashley. That's what I meant to say. Ashley. It's not Ash you, it's Ashley. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Anybody here from Germany? Oh, that's why you look so familiar. I gave you a lift once to Arnof. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
After Rabbi Shurin's wedding. Yeah, I didn't understand the word. The three girls were talking in the back seat. That I didn't understand. And then you went to Russian at some point. Like, what is it, German or Russian? I don't know. Okay, in any event.
Speak both.
Both. So Ashley says something brilliant. The Torah is eternal. Now, why is that so significant as a legal system? I mean, I'm not going to live till eternity, so I don't know if I have to, you know, whoopee-doo, you know, the Torah is eternal. But what's great about the Torah and the fact that it's eternal? Can anybody add something, Mrs. Krause?
Maybe because it doesn't just apply to individuals, it applies to a nation.
Okay, so that's pretty good. I thought you were going to say something else. Yes, it applies to a nation as well. But maybe we could create a legal system that would apply to nations. I don't know. But I would add something else. What's great about the Torah is that it applies to everything, to any situation that you could imagine. It's phenomenal. Any cultural changes, the Torah will have something to say. Technological changes. I read a book once about the legal status of Skype. And believe it or not, there are myriads of issues that the halacha has to address with regard to Skype. When I was a youngster, I remember they started what's called in Hebrew Hashtalat Evarim. Let's see if I can translate that for you. It's organ transplants, right? Organ transplants. When I was your age, a kidney transplant was a very complicated matter. Today, it's almost par for the course. And there's so many halachic issues. Can I dedicate or donate my kidney for someone else? And the halacha has to address this. The halacha is wonderful because you're getting an oral Torah with the ability to answer and respond to every single question at all times. Now, how can you codify that in a written text? And the answer is you cannot. It's impossible to write a written text that's eternal and that's going to answer and resolve every single situation. For that, we need what's called principles. And those principles are codified in the outline form that Moshe Rabbeinu took when he was at Har Sinai. That's called the oral Torah. Now, let's say I want to come along and I want to write the oral Torah down on paper. Can I commit the oral Torah to writing? Well, on the one hand, I would tell you that 99% of the books in our library here are written forms of the oral Torah. In fact, the largest set... Oh, it's not here. Sorry. But the largest set in any good Jewish library... Is there another library here?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good.
The basement.
So this is not the real library. What's the largest set in any good Jewish library? It's the Shas, right? All the Gemaras, all the Talmud. The Talmud is massive. It's 67 volumes, right? All that is the oral Torah. So how is it committed to writing? So here you have to know that there were two historical periods. We had a giant, a leader in Israel, who was as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, perhaps. His name was, if you can write it down, if you don't know it, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Judah the king, or the prince of Israel. And he lived almost at the beginning of the Common Era, maybe a little bit before the Common Era, let's say he lived 200 years before the Common Era, and he said the following. True, we're not allowed to write the oral Torah and convert it into a written law. We're not allowed to do so. We have to maintain the nature of the oral law as an oral law. But history has changed. The Jews are persecuted. The Jews are dispersed throughout the lands. We are no longer capable of continuing to teach the tradition and pass it on. And therefore, he said, we have to violate the Torah itself for the sake of the Torah. And only a great person of the stature of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was able to pull this off. And at that point in history, it became permissible to write down the oral Torah. Hence, we have the first, shall I say, contribution to the oral Torah in writing. What's that called? The very first?
The Mishnah.
And the Mishnah was edited by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. The greatness of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was not only in his leadership qualities, not only in his love for the people, but also he was a tremendous literary giant. He was able to codify the oral law in six sections of the Mishnah. Again, the six sections really, that's also complicated. There may have been many, many different sections before that, but he edited it. Now, when I say he edited it, what does that imply? That it was written before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the editor. And he took and he compiled and anthologized all those notes that were written. But the question that I want to ask you is, how are you allowed to write those notes? In other words, Rebbe is the one who makes this breakthrough. He's the one who's going to permit taking the oral Torah and transforming it into a written document. If Rebbe is the first to do so, how can I say at the same time that Rebbe collected all the written documents beforehand, anthologized them, and edited them? Who was allowed to write these documents before Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi? And that's called, I don't know if there's a possibility of writing something on a blackboard, but this is called a Megillat Starim. Now what is a Megillat Starim? These are what you call private notes. Okay? So I want to quote to you a scholar who died, I would say, I'm just guessing, about 20 years ago. His name was Reb Chaim Zimmerman. I don't know if there's anyone here who ever heard of him. And he authored many books, one of which is called The Binyan Halach. Now, in this book, he claims that the prohibition in joining us from converting the oral Torah into a written document only applies in public, which means that for the sake of the nation, I'm not allowed to change the way, to alter the way the Torah was given. If it was given in an oral way, it's got to be passed on orally. If it was given written, it's got to be passed on from a written document. But all that is only l'rabim. L'rabim means for the public. But as far as private notes are concerned, any individual who is so compelled to write notes because he's afraid he will forget what he heard is allowed to do so. So what Rebbe then did, Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, is he combined together all these Megillot Starim, these private notes, and he went through them meticulously with a great deal of effort until finally he edited the Mishnah because he was a literary giant.
God knew he was going to be exiled. Why would, if God knew that we were going to be sent to the four corners of the earth, why would we only receive
permission,
so much of the Torah as the oral law if there was a chance that it would have, like,
again, there's what you call the ideal, and then it's the real. The ideal is the oral Torah that's passed on from mouth to mouth, from teacher to student. That's the ideal. Because of the diaspora, we had to find a fallback position. A b'di'evid. B'di'evid means this is something that we have to live with, that we have to do the best we can for the sake of continuing the Torah. But in the ideal world, the Torah was meant to be passed on orally. And the greatness of an oral tradition is that, as we said before, it's infinite, because as soon as you write it down, you commit it to writing, it becomes confined and constricted. The greatness of an oral tradition is that it engenders a very powerful relationship between the teacher and the student. And what it means is that the student cannot just write notes. The student has to confer and consult with his rabbi, with his teacher, and together they work it out. The beauty of Torah is that Torah is not objective in the sense that it's written and it's clear. That's true for the Torah Shebichtav, and we believe that we have the exact Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah that Moshe received at Har Sinai. But the beauty of it is that there's a Torah which is oral, and that Torah works with principles, and you have to understand those principles and analyze them, and you ask questions and you get answers, and together in this very exciting learning experience you work out the truth. I'll give you an example. I don't know if you women have been to college or graduate school. Have you ever taken a seminar? In a seminar, you may have five people sitting around a room and working things out. This one says that, and this one asks a question, this one gives a different answer and a different perspective. You get the entire picture. That's the beauty of the oral tradition. That's called, in Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's language, giving up on an ideal, because otherwise we're going to have to throw in the towel. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi realized that it's an either-or situation. We have two choices. If we continue the oral tradition, then we're going to lose it all. It's worth it to give up on the ideal so that we still have a tradition of Torah. Okay. Let me go on, if I can, to another point. As I said at the outset, all of what we know and most of what we experience in Torah learning is controversy, debates, differences of opinion. Some of those differences have far-reaching implications. Perhaps the most famous adversaries in Torah, adversaries not in a personal sense, but in terms of they had clashing views, was what we call Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai were at each other's throats, so to speak, and they had major differences of opinion, to the extent to which the Gemara tells us, in this is in Masechet Yevamos, that because of their different views in terms of family relationships and who could marry whom, the offspring of Beit Shammai could not intermarry with the offspring of Beit Hillel, and back and forth. The debate between Hillel and Shammai was so broad that it threatened to create two different Jewish communities. And I asked myself the question, why do we need all this debate, all this controversy? Today in our time, we have Hasidim. and we have those who are opposed to Hasid, and we have Sfaradim, and we have Ashkenazim, and it keeps going on and on. It's endless. You always have controversy. You always have machloket, you always have a debate. Who needs it all? Now, one could argue cynically that all that debate is simply a result of what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was facing in his time, the diaspora, the fact that Jews are spread across the earth. But then we have a different principle. And this sheds a whole other light. This you'll find if you want to look in your booklet on page 44. This is called Elu V'Elu. What's Elu V'Elu? Very strange. These and these. And what our rabbis established, girls, listen to this. If you've never heard of this, this could knock your socks off. Elu V'Elu, there are two sides in a debate. They're both Torah. What do you mean they're both Torah? How could Beis Hillel be Torah when Beit Shammai says you're wrong? And vice versa. Elu V'Elu Divrei Elokim Chai. Very strange. He has here a little bit of a diagram. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. Have you ever seen this? This is quite famous. The old woman and the young woman. It's on page 46. Man, this is... You know, I keep looking at the one on the left and I keep seeing the old woman. I look at the one on the right and I see the young woman. Okay, I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's pretty famous in psychology. Alright? So I don't know, I'm curious to know if we had the time for this to do a census. You know, how many people would agree with me that the woman on the left looks like the young woman? Well, how many people would say she looks like the old woman?
I don't see an old woman.
And how many people on the right, you know, anyway, whichever way. It's very true. The eye plays strange tricks because once you see the lady on the left as an old woman, it may take you a little bit of time to see her as a young woman. Yeah, you know, because you get used to seeing the old woman. You know. In any event,
I see both.
This kind of experiment, and there are many, many such examples, led the social scientists, you know, to come to the conclusion that truth depends upon your perspective. And you can have two people looking at the same thing and they see different things. It's almost like light coming through a prism and you can see different shades of light. In modern physics, there's a certain belief that maybe there's a reality beyond our reality. And these are not necessarily monotheists who believe in God, you know. These become a paradigm for the concept called Elu V'Elu. And according to our rabbis, I'm getting distracted again, girls. Sorry. According to our rabbis, when Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to the mountain, he actually receives, for every single halachic principle, 49 perspectives that would lead to one conclusion and 49 perspectives that would lead to the opposite conclusion. What it means is that the Torah itself has what we call multiple perspectives. And two people could look at the Torah and the same exact halacha, and the question is prioritizing which is the main or the primary element, which is the secondary element, and both are elements, and both are true. So we come to the following conclusions, pretty way out. Elu V'Elu. If we accept the view of Beis Hillel, for example, against Beis Shammai, what happens if I want to study the Torah of Beis Shammai? Is that a waste of time? Why did Rebbe bother codifying Beit Shammai's view? We don't paskin, we don't accept it. But La Halacha knows the final laws on it is with Beis Hillel. So why bother studying Shammai? I mean, we don't accept his opinion. But the answer is Elu V'Elu. That both are true. Now, it's true that both are true, but I have to know, in a practical sense, how to live my life. Now a whole new set of regulations emerge. And these regulations are called halakha. Halakha means we have to know how to determine what we call normative halakha. And now there are rules. For example, in the case of Hillel and Shammai, who do we accept? As I mentioned before, we accept Hillel. But it doesn't mean that Shammai is less true than Hillel. In fact, the Kabbalists claim that ultimately we're going to accept the view of Shammai, that Shammai had a deeper view of the Torah, more profound, more original, and more true, if you will. But it's a matter of how to live your life. So there are two levels of Torah. There's one level of Torah, I'll be right with you, which is the abstract idea of truth. And then there's another level of Torah that's the practical issue of how do I live my life? How do I behave? How do I respond in any particular scenario? Yes? What was your name?
Tori.
Say it one more time.
Tori?
With a T.
Yeah. Wait, can you give an example?
Again, I'll give you the following example, and the examples are just endless. The question is, how do you organize the parashiyot? There are four parashiyot in the Tefillin Shel Rosh, in the head tefillin. And there's one opinion which is Rashi's opinion. There's another opinion which is Rabbeinu Tam's opinion. Anybody know the relationship between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam?
Isn't that his
grandfather and grandson? Okay, so the grandson disagrees with his grandfather about how to put... Now, watch what goes on over here. The order, the sequence of the parashiyot in these four compartments, I don't know if you've ever visited a tefillin factory, it's very worthwhile. There's one right here, Mamish, a few feet from where we are, and they have a whole video for a half hour. They show you how they make the tefillin. It's absolutely fascinating. And the halacha is that if you make a mistake in placing the wrong parchment in the wrong compartment, meaning the sequence of the parashiyot, is absolutely critical. So what do we do? So there are those, I don't know if you know this, who wear two pairs of tefillin. They wear one pair, which is called Rashi's tefillin, and then they wear another pair of tefillin, which is called Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. In fact, there are some very holy people who will wear two pairs of tefillin at the same time. That's going a little too far. But anyway, we can talk about that a different time. So I'm not telling you that we have to wear Rashi's tefillin or Rabbeinu Tam is wrong. I'm telling you that we have to wear Rashi's tefillin because the normative halacha, the practical halacha, was accepted according to Rashi. We will study Rabbeinu Tam. We will delve into Rabbeinu Tam. If a person dedicated himself to study Rabbeinu Tam's opinion for the rest of his life, every minute he's involved in the mitzvah, the great mitzvah of studying Torah. But in terms of which tefillin we're going to wear, in a practical sense, we're going to wear Rashi's tefillin. Tori, you with me at all? Okay, good. I wanted to talk to you a few minutes about a concept called Halacha Moshe Misina. Okay, let me write that down on the board. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. You know what? I don't think you can read what I write.
There's a red marker.
The red is better. Okay, let's try red. Okay, now. Okay, we can write it in Hebrew and then in English. Is this any better?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. In English, we'll try to do it this way. Halacha le Moshe mi Sina. Okay. Now, this concept is very, very rare. Why? Because this is a case of an unbroken tradition. To such an extent that Maimonides, the Rambam, writes that there's no controversy about a halacha l'Moshe Misina. What's unique about halacha l'Moshe Misina? We're talking about the oral law. And we're talking about someone getting up and quoting, this halakha is a halakha l'Moshe Misinai. Says the Rambam, that's a good way of winning a debate. Because once you invoke halakha l'Moshe Misinai, there's no room for controversy. No one could argue with you. It's solid like the rock of Gibraltar. Who's here from Gibraltar? No. Okay, just thought. How many? Just curious, how many girls in this class have ever been to Gibraltar? Not too many? Okay. You have to go. It's, yeah,
so is this like, no. He's from Broadway. So for like a halakha l'Moshe Sinai, is that like the eighth pre-Hadar, like the beautiful, like the eighth pre-Hadar, like a beautiful
Correct.
So like an etrog. Right. So like
correct.
No one goes around.
No one would debate about an etrog. You can't have Sfaradim taking one etrog and Ashkenazim a different etrog, and etrog is an etrog. Okay. Now, I want to tell you. I want to tell you a piece of the development of Halakha. One of the great controversies historically in Halakha was about a certain woman, one of the greatest women in Jewish history. She was a convert.
Ruth.
Anybody know who I have in mind?
This is Ruth.
Ruth. Ruth came from which nation?
Moab.
Moab. The Torah says, Amoni u'Moavi lo yavo b'kal Hashem, which means that the descendants of Moab could never enter into the Jewish people. Now, who comes from Ruth? She marries Boaz, and her great-grandson is David HaMelech, who's the father of Mashiach, who's the great king of Israel, David HaMelech. And his great-grandmother was not allowed to enter into the Jewish people. So this created an amazing controversy to such an extent that there were a group of rabbis who wanted to declare David HaMelech, that King David is not part of the Jewish people. Why? Because the marriage between Ruth and Boaz was illegitimate. She had no right, and he had no right to marry her, to enter into the Jewish people. She could convert if she likes, but she can't marry. Could you imagine what's at stake in this controversy? It came to the point of almost, I would say guns, but they didn't have guns in those days, of swords. That's how ferocious and fierce the debate was all about. The Gemara tells us a whole story about how the debate evolved. This opinion, counter opinion, another opinion, back and forth. And at some point in time, the controversy ends. And Ruth is declared legitimate. Her marriage to Boaz is validated. And David HaMelech has the great lineage and the rights to be king of Israel. What happened? How did the debate finally terminate? So there was someone named Doeg. Okay, Doeg, D-O-A-G, I guess, and he was the anti, he was the one who said no. You know, the Torah says that a Moabite cannot enter into the Jewish people, and therefore this is illegitimate. Then there was somebody by the name of Amsa, and he was on the other side, and he said the Torah only prohibited a Moavi, only a male member, a descendant of Moab, can't enter, but a female Moaviah can enter. And they try to bring proofs back and forth. The Torah says, why do we exclude the Moavim from the sense of Moav? Shalokidmu eschem b'lechem amayim. When the Jewish people were out there, they were thirsty, they were hungry, and the Moavim refused cruelly to spare and share their food and their supplies with the Jewish people. This cruelty, we can't accept Moav. And then the debate began. Well, maybe the women of Moav are not guilty. What do you mean the women aren't guilty? Why didn't they come out and bring lechem u'mayim and bring bread and water? Ah, kol kvoda basmelech pnim. A woman has to be modest. She has to stay behind the scenes. You can't fault the women of Moab for not going out there and giving food to the Jewish people. So the Gemara, no, that's not true. The women could have given food and drink to whom? To the Jewish women. The men of Moab should have been, they were faulted for not having sympathy for the Jewish men, and the women of Moab were guilty of not having sympathy for the Jewish women, and that wouldn't have violated modesty in any way. And this goes on and on and on, until finally, one of the greats gets up and he says the following. I'm going to say it in Hebrew and then I'll translate it. Kach mikublani mi beitin shel Shmuel hanavi, Moavi v'lo Moaviah. This is what I heard from Shmuel the great prophet, that the Torah prohibits a male member of Moab and permits a female. And at that point, the whole debate terminates. So there was a great rabbi. He was my Rebbe's uncle. His name was the Brisker Rav. There was a city back in Poland called Brisk. He was the Rav of Brisk. His name was Rav Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik. Okay, then? Rabbi Shurin will tell you how he's related to that great rabbi. In any event, so Rav Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik says the following. What turned the tides? And what cemented and determined forevermore that you cannot question the lineage of David? Mikublani, when he says, I received this from Shmuel Hanavi, he means Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. What is a Halacha L'Moshe Misinai? It's a tradition that's unbroken, that could be traced from one student up to his rabbi, from his rabbi to his rabbi, his teacher, until you eventually, in this Chagadah, you get all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu himself. At that point, the debate terminates for all times. This was a halacha that was passed on from mouth to mouth in an unbroken tradition that takes us from Moshe Rabbeinu all the way to Shmuel HaNavi. Now, as you know, Maimonides is one of the greatest sources for the tradition, because what Maimonides did is he researched and he wrote an extensive introduction to his magnum opus, which is called the Mishneh Torah, in which he tells you from Moshe Rabbeinu how the Torah was handed down. What do we know even before the Rambam? Anybody remember a certain Mishnah? Well, if you haven't learned this Mishnah, it's going to be very important for us. This is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that begins Masechet Avot, the tractate of Avot, and it says Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. Moshe received the Torah at Har Sinai. Umisaro Yoshua, he passed it on to Yoshua. Yoshua Lizkanim, Zkanim Lenevian, and it goes through the entire tradition. The Rambam takes that Mishnah much further, and he goes into great detail. And Shmuel, the great prophet Shmuel, is in that tradition. He is one of the people who got the unbroken word from the oral Torah that was passed on from Moshe Rabbeinu all the way to Shmuel. And now the Gemara says that Shmuel told us, in the name of his rabbi, who in turn heard it from his rabbi, that this is halacha l'moshe misinai. That a Moavi is not allowed to enter into the people, but a Moaviyah is allowed to enter into the Jewish people. And that's what did it. And that's why we have David HaMelech as the king of Israel. So when I say to you that Halacha L'Moshe Misinai has a special status, you can imagine the implications of that statement. Okay. How are we doing on the clock? We still have a few more minutes?
15.
All right. I want you to turn, if you can, to page 77. Now, on page 77, you'll find actually on page 76, going on to 77, the history of what we call the Shulchan Aruch. If there are any girls here in the room who are not embarrassed to tell me what the Shulchan Aruch, what is it all about? Anybody willing to volunteer for that?
Day-to-day
halakha. Who authored the Shulchan Aruch and when? Okay, a little bit of history, yeah? Excellent, Rabbi Yosef Kairo. How many centuries ago?
Five
centuries ago. Rabbi Shurin, did I say something wrong?
No. I said to Liza, if someone asks you who are the Shulchan Aruch, now you're going to know.
So we used to refer to the Shulchan Aruch as Maran. Maran. Now Maran means Rav Vadi Yosef. But okay, the old days, I'm from the old country here. Maran was a reference to our great rabbi, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo. How many women here have ever been to his burial place? Only one? Two? Wow, you have to go to Tzfat. And one of the highlights of your trip to Tzfat is to say a few prayers at the burial place of Rav Yosef Karo, the great author of the Shulchan Aruch, because he lived most of his life in Tzfat, in the city of Tzfat. There are a lot of other greats who are buried in the same cemetery. It's really worth the trip. And they let women go too, so don't get nervous. Okay. Now, Rav Yosef Cairo writes an entire introduction as to why he took it upon himself this job, this task, to codify Jewish law. And in this very long introduction, which you'll see on pages 77, 76, 77 in this booklet, he basically says the following. Back in the day, Rav Yehuda Nasi wrote the Mishnah. That was a major move. And it really undermined the whole concept of the oral tradition. But he did it because it was necessary. The other alternative was that the Torah would be forgotten. And Rav Yosef Cairo says, with a great deal of humility, that in our generation, the Torah is so confusing. Nobody knows what the halacha is, and there's so much confusion and debates back and forth. I want to take it upon myself to go through, and he gives you a list of all the following writings, and to simplify them and summarize them and come to some final conclusion. The list that he offers us of books that he goes through, some of them were in manuscript form, because keep in mind the printing press was about the time of Rav Yosef Cairo. Actually, the printing press goes back to the 1400s. Now, after the expulsion, which is in 1492, the Jews left Spain and they were spread out all over the diaspora. And from that point on, the tradition became very weak. And Rav Yosef Cairo, about the year 1500, took it upon himself to go through all of the great scholarly works, which he lists, he enumerates, it's a long list, and codify the halacha. And there are two great contributions going on here. Number one, that a human being would be capable of going through all this material, massive amount of material. And number two, he does something else. And that's called hachra'ah, which means to make a final decision. What is the greatness of the Shulchan Aruch? If you would tell me he's a great scholar, yes. If you're telling me he did an enormous amount of work and research, yes. But that's not it. The real greatness of the Shulchan Aruch is that after he gathers together all these material and he compares and contrasts all the opinions, and there's a great deal of confusion because there's so many different views on any topic, he says, I am going to decide the halacha. How do you do that? Girls, you're all fully familiar with the word, I don't know if it's Hebrew or if it's an international word, called chutzpah. What a chutzpah! Rav Yosef Cairo, you're great, you're a scholar, you're a giant, you're everything. I love you. But don't tell me that you have the ability to codify final decisions on endless number of issues. How can you do such a thing? What gall, what gumption do you have to offer a hachra'ah, a final decision? Says Rav Yosef Cairo the following. The three greatest halachic decisors, you know, poskim, are the Rif, I'll explain, the Rambam, and the Tur. Okay. Now this last one, the Tur, that's very complicated. He was the son of the Rosh, and he basically stands on the shoulders of what we call the Balei HaTosfot. The Balei HaTosfot, to a large extent, live in Ashkenaz, in countries like Germany and France, and they represent one tradition. The Rambam, on the other hand, is in Spain, spends a lot of his life in Cairo and Egypt, and that's a different tradition. The Rif is called Al-Fasi, and he also represents a tradition. Says Rav Yosef Cairo, I'm going to make a long story short. I'm going to assume that all the debates that went on for centuries are all condensed and decided by these three greats, these three giants. And now we have a rule, majority rules. the number three is an odd number. Whenever there's two out of three in one opinion, that's how we're going to decide that one. And this approach of Rav Yosef Cairo five centuries ago is still very much alive and in vogue today. And I mentioned Rav Ovadia Yosef. Now, Rav Ovadia Yosef, as you know, passed away 4 years ago. We just commemorated the anniversary, the fourth anniversary of his death, the fourth Yahrzeit. And I remember when he came to our yeshiva in Washington Heights, Manhattan, New York, if anybody knows the place. It's called Yeshiva University, and he gave a lecture. I was a member of a class, I think it was a great class, we were over 100 students, that was taught by Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rav Yosef Cairo uses this rule called majority rules, and Rav Ovadia Yosef, five centuries later, uses the same rule. Majority decides halacha. Only Rav Ovadia Yosef could do such a thing because he knew everything. The man had a photographic memory. I don't know if you know, there is a computer program called the Bar Ilan Responsa. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a computer that moves and calculates at the speed of light thousands, if not tens of thousands of different responsa literature. When they told Rav Ovadia Yosef about it, he went like that. He was unimpressed. So they said, wait a minute, we're going to test you. So they asked him a question. And he rattles off 69 answers to the question. Ah, you missed two. The computer spit out 71 answers. They checked the other two. They were written by he himself, Rav Ovadia Yosef. I forgot the tshuvas that I had written. Imagine a human being who can answer a question quoting 69 sources without breathing a breath of air. So he came to our yeshiva and he gave a shiur. I remember the topic of the shiur, whether we recite Hallel on Yom HaTzma'ut with a bracha, without a bracha. And basically, he developed a whole halachic system, and he quoted every rabbi that I never ever heard of. You know, the rabbi in Pechuch, in Turkey, I don't know where, and he lists like tens and tens of rabbis. Kedarko Bakodesh, that's the way Rabbi Yosef was. And then he says, majority rules. And since the majority at that time was in favor of omitting the bracha, that was his final conclusion.
You say it, but
so after the shiur was over, a couple of us were very chutzpahdik, and we went over to Rav Soloveitchik and we asked him, what'd you think of the shiur? Now you couldn't be cold and unimpressed by, you know, Rav Ovadia Yosef quoting 1,000 tshuvas in an hour, you know, but they'd say, like, this is amazing. He didn't have a note in front of him. So Rav Soloveitchik said the following. Watch this, girls. Who says that majority rules? Where does he know that from? There is a halacha that majority rules, but it only applies to something called what?
Sanhedrin.
Correct. Okay? So now we're going to end the class with a discussion about the Sanhedrin. Okay? This was the great corpus of 70 elders, and the Torah says that when the members of this high court, the highest court in Israel, have a debate and they have to come to some decision, the Torah says, Achrei Rabba Lahatus, majority rules. Says Rav Soloveitchik, majority rules, because you've got 70 elders in a room together, debating. Each one is a great scholar, and now we can count them. That's called Amido Laminion. They stand up and they vote. And we can count the votes. And we end up with a majority. Amongst the various tshuvas that Rav Ovadia Yosef had quoted in that lecture, one of them was Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Now, girls, I would probably have to stand here for years and years to try to tell you how gigantic Rabbi Akiva Eiger was. He was one of the most profound thinkers of all times. you probably could have made two Einsteins out of his brain. And in the same lecture, almost in the same breath, Rav Avadia Yosef quotes the Rav of Pichuch. I just made up that name. Meaning a rabbi from Turkey that you and I never heard of. So Rav Soloveitchik says, you're going to determine, because, you know, we've got Rabbi Kivik on one side, and the rabbi of Pichuch on the other side, and then you're going to add one other rabbi who we never heard of, and then you're going to say the halach is like the majority. That's not how it works. There's a tradition. There's a method that evolves over the course of centuries of halachic thinking and decisions in halachic issues. You can't just snap your finger and tell me that you know every rabbi, even if you have the photographic memory of Rav Avadia Yosef, that you know every rabbi who ever lived for the last 2,000 years who had an opinion on this question. There's no way that you can determine by counting numbers and counting heads and majority rules. Now, girls, you'll have to take what I just said, if you take it seriously, and debate this with the other members of the staff here. Because I have no doubt that there are other people here in Midrashet Rachel, what?
Vachaya.
Okay. The Vachaya, I think, is more recent. I don't remember. I was here many years ago. We didn't have Vachaya, I don't think. Maybe it didn't. I didn't know. But Midrashet Rachel, Vachaya. And you'll probably find that some of the rabbis here, or Rebbetzins here, I don't know who teaches you, will be very upset with what I told you. But I'm just telling you a true story about what happened on Erev Yom HaTzmaut in the year 1975, I think it was. Okay, that's going back home. So girls, I want to leave you with this very probing thought. And it has tremendous implications as far as our discussion of the development of halakha. Is there such a thing as majority rules? And what I'd like you to see on page 77 is on the bottom here a quote from the Yamshel Shlomo. Okay, he was one of the greats. He was basically lived in the same generation as Rav Yosef Kaira. Maybe he was a younger contemporary. And when he read the introduction of Rav Yosef Kaira to the great work, the Shulchan Aruch, He was livid. He went ballistic. If you read this presentation here, again, it's on page 77. It's the main paragraph going up from the bottom, not the top paragraph. You will see how angry, how upset, and almost insulted he was that Rav Yosef Kaira could reduce all of halacha to three greats, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Tur, and then apply the rule, majority rules. What about the thousands of years of halachic thinking of greats and giants that are myriad in number? Are you able to just look aside and obscure them as if they didn't exist? Can you have the audacity to reduce all of halacha to three different poskim? And then apply majority rules? The Yamshel Shlomo had zero tolerance for it. And he was therefore opposed to the very essence of the writing of the Shulchan Aruch. So next time, Yitzhak Shev, if you're interested in getting together again, that's up to you. Next Thursday, same time, same station. And hopefully I'll find legal parking next time I come. Because I don't know what I'm going to find on my car when I move. But in any event, I'd like to see if we can somehow figure out how is it that the Shulchan Aruch of Rav Yosef Kaira became the final word for all of halacha for the last five centuries. Okay then? I'll let you go. Thank if you. Anyone has any questions, I'm
please
here.
Stay. Yaffa wants us to stay for Tehillah.
Oh, wow. That's important.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Everyone should have a great day.